The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Yes, Sinead Burke is with me in studio, the disability advocate, the founder and CEO of Tilting the Lens, former cover model of Vogue. Sinead, that was 6 years ago, was it?
Yeah, 6 years ago. Yeah, 2019.
Do people still kind of introduce you that way?
You just did. So, Yes. You know, what a privilege. I mean, I got to be the first little person to be on the cover of Vogue in 2019. And then, you know, 4 years later, through Tilting the Lens, got to be a consulting editor on the 2023 issue in May, which was around reframing fashion, creating greater disability representation and greater accessibility. But it is both a real privilege and I think a call to action to not just think about oneself on the cover of Vogue, but how do we create more accessibility in fashion and beyond?
But being on the cover of something like that, I mean, it's a personal honour, I guess, and a kind of a personal achievement on some level as well. Does it have tangible impacts, though, on you and the business and everything else and the direction of your life?
If I think about the 2019 covers, and maybe to give some context, so the September issue of Vogue, of every issue, whether it's American Vogue or British Vogue, is usually the largest issue in terms of advertising revenue, but it's often usually the most important issue in terms of seasonal direction for the fashion industry. So thinking about Fashion Week is just about to start in September. So the September issue is important and always has been. I think in terms of this particular issue, this one was guest edited by Meghan Markle, the Duchess of Sussex, and on it she had put together a number of women that she had admired, for example. And I think that level of visibility and representation created a greater awareness for my work, not just here in Ireland, but on a global scale. And I think about how the editor-in-chief at the time, Edward Enninful, was the first black man to hold that role, and the work that he did to create visibility and representation for lots of different types of people who I think previously were excluded in fashion. But it was, you know, personally a very surreal and wonderful moment. But I think it was also a moment that gave me deep reflection. You know, it was just before the pandemic. Then the pandemic happened. I was at home in County Meath with my parents and really trying to navigate a world where so much, when we think about the medical model of disability or disability and eugenics, were playing out in real time in front of us all. You know, we had never had greater proximity to disability as a collective than within the pandemic. I think about how many of us maybe lost somebody or knew somebody who lost someone. And our immediate response was, well, were they vulnerable? Did they have underlying conditions? Yeah. As if it was okay that they died, which is in turn reiterating this narrative that to be disabled is to be less than or less valuable in society. And I look to England, and in the first wave of the pandemic, 6 out of 10 people who died of COVID-19 were disabled. So being able to take that monumental personal achievement of being on the cover of Vogue, then having the pandemic, it made me ask the question of, did the fashion industry become more accessible because I was part of it, or did it become more accessible for me? I think there is answers to both of those questions, but individual success is not system change. And that motivated me to set up the business and set up Tilting the Lens in October 2020 and really tried to create that system change.
What does this say to you, or what did it say to you at the time that we were so quick to retreat to that mindset? You know, that it's okay that those people died. Those people had an underlying condition. And the underlying condition could have been something as benign as asthma. But we were just, you know, it was a sense that, as you said, somehow their life is kind of slightly less important that that person died. It's not as impactful as somebody just dying of COVID. So don't worry about it.
Yeah, I think my personal opinion is that it doesn't matter what the underlying condition is. People have a right to exist, not despite their disability, but because of their disability, because they are citizens of society. And I think it is entrenched in what we perceive as value. We often think about people's value in their productivity, people's value in their capacity to participate, but participate in what? People's value exists in being humans and being human beings. And I think, you know, what brought us to the point of retracting, I think I would probably argue the point that it wasn't a retraction, in the sense that if we even think about day-to-day conversations that happen in society, for example, you know, if somebody becomes pregnant, we ask them the gender of their baby, which is not a question I think we should be asking, but we ask them. And usually the typical response from that person is, I just want my baby to be healthy. And what they mean by that whether or not they articulate it, is that they hope that their baby is not disabled, which then means that if you are a parent who has a child that has a disability, you then go through a trauma, you then experience grief for the child that you thought you were going to have that you didn't have, you then feel a sense of shame. And perhaps that question or that response comes from challenges that we hear or see with services, a lack of representation of disabled adults, of disabled leaders. But I don't think it's a retraction. I don't think the pandemic brought us back to an earlier, more primitive form of ourselves as regards to disability. I think it's in us every day.
So the answer to that question, that you want the baby to be healthy, and the implication of same, is that then that attitude born of society? So on some level it's a contrivance, or is it just kind of a natural evolutionary attitude to have?
Say more.
In terms of the idea that a disability, as we would call it today, would have been seen as life-limiting for much of our existence as a species, and there's a kind of a hangover attitude to that, which is a kind of a cross community kind of cultural inclination to, as you say, the kind of the I want my baby to be healthy, in other words, not have a disability, or does it just speak of a kind of a prejudice, an underlying prejudice against a disability?
I think it's probably all of those things. And I also think it's probably a lack of awareness, a lack of self-consciousness. Like, I think about how, you know, just as a society, we have all of these scripts that we perform. You ask somebody how they are, they say, I'm busy. How are you? Busy, right? What gender is your baby? I don't know. I just want the baby to be healthy. I'm not sure every single pregnant person is contemplating or thinking about whether or not they want to be a disabled, or they want to have and be a parent of a disabled child. I think it's a script that we have given permission to have as a collective society. But I think it is also ingrained in the fabric of Irish society, but the fabric of global society. If we look at the models of disability, for example, you know, whether that is the eugenics model of disability, the medical model of disability, which is the idea that disability is something to be cured. And I think many disabled people, particularly those with chronic illnesses, for example, are very grateful, understandably, for pharmaceutical innovation. But it's that idea that, you know, we have this assumption that to not be disabled is the ideal. And for me, as a person, I'm very proud to be disabled and wouldn't want to be non-disabled, because it has irrevocably shaped who I am. I think we then also have the social model of disability, which is the notion that disabled people are disabled by design, right? So I came into the studio today and I'm sitting on a chair that has wheels, but it was too high, right? And very quickly before we went live on air, we had to figure out and fix a solution. And that, you know, made me anxious before going on the air. Other guests don't have to manage that before they come on and do an interview, but I have to do that because I'm disabled by design. We then have the rights-based model, which is the UN Convention on the Rights of People with Disabilities, or the European Accessibility Act. And then we have, you know, kind of the justice-based model, which is around intersectionality, making sure that we acknowledge that disabled people exist across every community, to your point. And when we think about solutions and strategies and policies to support disabled people to thrive in society, we should do that, ensuring that we leave nobody behind. So I think, you know, the answer to your question is that, yes, it's part of the historic fabric of who we are as a society. Yes, it's part of a bias and a discrimination and an ableism that exists. Some of it is a lack of consciousness, but I think it's also due to a lack of representation, a lack of ambition when we think about disabled people. You know, when I set up Tilting the Lens, one of the things that I was aware of as a disabled female entrepreneur is that when we look at the data here in Ireland as regards to disability employment, only 15% of disabled women are in employment. That is a statistic that we should be mobilized to change, both from a recruitment, a retention, and a promotion perspective, as quickly and as efficiently as possible. And those are drivers that we need to make change in order for that conversation, for that unconscious response to eventually change over time.
Do labels matter in this regard? You know, the use of the word disability and the implication, maybe subconsciously or unconsciously, of saying that, you know, that it's not the ideal.
So language is really nuanced, and I am somebody who revels in that nuance of language. When you look at the etymology, meaning the historic makeup of the word disability, and if we look to the, you know, Latin interpretation of dis, that in and of itself is a negative, right? If we think about dysfunctioning, for example, or if we think about other kind of words that start with dis. But what I think we also see, not just in disability, but in so many other communities, is a reclamation of words. Now, what we have found historically, both in Ireland and globally, is a lack of use of the word disability or a move away from it, particularly of non-disabled parents of disabled children, because again, to identify their child as disabled feels negative. So we've seen the kind of evolution of terminology such as special needs or differently abled. And I think what we're seeing both here in Ireland, but also globally, is disabled advocates and disabled adults themselves challenge that. You know, I have access needs, but my needs are not special. I have a right to be able to engage equitably in this interview and in this studio. And by specialising them, both in terms of how we define special education, but also needs, it allows us to distance ourselves from our obligation. And if we think about the language of differently abled, yes, we want to talk about what a person is able to do. But there is ableism in that also. You know, there are things that we can all do, but there are also things that we all can't do. And instead of, you know, striving for this notion of independence as a definition of success, the reality is we are all interdependent of one another. And why can that not be the goal? Everybody is different in how they choose to be comfortable or how they choose to use language. For me, being disabled is positive. I see it as part of my identity. I am proud to be disabled. I am proud to be part of the disabled community. But other people have a discomfort with that. We can't dictate how other disabled people prefer to describe themselves or talk to themselves. Mm. But I do think with disability in particular, and I find this in my day-to-day practice, whether I'm working with senior leaders at a global company, whether I'm supporting governments and policy development, or whether I'm working in the arts, oftentimes what I find is people say, I don't know what to say, which means they say nothing, which in turn means they do nothing. And I really think we need a greater appetite to get beyond this notion of conversation.
Yeah.
And it's this idea that we're kind of complacent because if we feel that we don't know what to say, because we're worried about being uncomfortable.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask. Well, that's born of just fear of discomfort. I might say the wrong thing and insult you later.
No, we're fear of being embarrassed.
Okay.
We're afraid of saying the wrong thing and that we'll look bad. We might be, and we might tell ourselves that we're afraid of making Sinead uncomfortable. But what you will leave, or what the mental narrative is when you leave, is going, why did I say that? I made such an idiot of myself. Why did I do that? And we make it about ourselves. So in order to prioritise ourselves, we don't enter into that conversation, which just means that we further give ourselves permission to exclude people. So we really need to move beyond this notion of discomfort, sit with the discomfort. We will learn something from it. I think if you are leading with good intentions, and if we have a conversation about language and say, Sinead, I'm not sure what to say, I will support you. Now, it's not the job of every disabled person to educate every non-disabled person as to what language is required. But I think if you lead with good intentions, if you try, if you learn, if you try again, that is how we will get faster.
Is there, I mean, this idea, though, of the reclamation of the label,
sure,
or the word disability, I mean, is there an element of the kind of the Sisyphean in it? If it has those negative connotations with so much in society, it's fine for you to kind of to say you're reclaiming it for yourself.
Sure.
But if for everybody else, when they hear it, it elicits that negative response on some level. I mean, are you kind of pushing the boulder up the hill?
I mean, I think we've seen many communities be successful in that. And I think, you know, we're not at the early point of the maturity model here with the disabled community. I think, you know, whether it's looking at disability representation at the Oscars, whether it's looking at increased disabled people in employment, increased disabled people sitting on boards, you know, it's not new in terms of this notion of the reclamation. What we have seen in other jurisdictions globally, for example, is, you know, the UAE as a country and as a territory has created new language. So they don't use the language of disability. Instead, they use the language of people of determination. And that works for them and their culture. Sometimes people criticize it because I guess it's a question of, are disabled people determined because that is who they are, or because they have to be, because they live within systems and structures? I think the reality is we will probably never all agree on language. But when do we stop allowing the debate or the conversation around language to be the only definition of progress?
So what then does progress look like for you?
Personally or professionally?
Personally.
Personally, for me, I founded the business 4.5 years ago. I have a majority disabled team who live and work across Europe. They are in Berlin, in Belfast, in Dublin, in Aberdeen, in London, and in Madrid. And what I want to do personally is use that as a model to showcase what psychological safety, reasonable adjustments, accessibility and good practice can look like as an opportunity for scaling. But really, very personally, my goal is to work with organizations, businesses, governments, disability advocates individually to try to create the conditions for disabled people to be successful. You know, the work that I do is across three pillars: built environment, product and service design, and people and workplace culture. And the reason for that is by targeting those three areas, I think what you can do is create those conditions for people to be successful. And always striving to do that by centering disabled people, understanding that their lived experience is intellectual property and that they have solutions based on the lives that they have lived and understanding what those pain points are, and always trying to move beyond baseline standards and compliance.
I'm really going to butcher the ancient Greek metaphor, and I'm going to go back to my favourite character and Sisyphus. Which of those is the steepest hill? The built environment, product design, or workplace culture?
My honest answer is that it depends on the jurisdiction and it depends on the company.
In Ireland?
In Ireland. So interestingly, around the built environment, for example, the European Accessibility Act came into law on June 28th, 2025. We as a country, within our kind of translation of the European Accessibility Act, did not choose to put the built environment in as part of it. So we have 20 years to remediate certain parts of our built environment within kind of the public forum to become accessible. But what does that look like? How do we define accessible? I think one of the great things that we have seen in Ireland is a real strive to compliance. But I was in a building just last week here in Centre Dublin, and beautiful new building, all glass. You can imagine the type, you know, go through the doors and you kind of still smell the distinct smell of white paint. And, you know, there is a counter that is low at reception, at least a portion of it. But that's where the flowers are stored. That's where the awards are stored. So I have to make myself known and try to, you know, get somebody to come to my attention, because even though it's compliant, it's not actually accessible. It's not actually usable. I then get into the elevator and go upstairs, and but the door is locked and you have to press a button and kind of speak to somebody in order to get in for security reasons, understandably. But that's at the height of 5.5 feet tall, because that doesn't fit within compliance. That isn't listed as a requirement within regulation. So it's not about whether or not we're meeting compliance. It's not about whether or not we are creating that access. The question is about how are we continuously iterating what we define compliance to be, evolving it, and how do we over time create more and more case studies and examples of best practice. And it's a little bit of a chicken and egg situation. We're working on a building in London at the moment and have been for the past 3 years. It will open next year. And what we know about this company is there isn't very many disabled people, or at least those who have self-identified as disabled, in the building. But we want this building to be a space where disabled people can be employed and thrive there over the long term. And even in having conversations with the architects, we're talking about putting a changing places bathroom in, which is a very specific type of bathroom that has a hoist, it has a wet room, it has a changing table that will hold the weight of an adult. There isn't somebody in that building who currently needs a changing places bathroom. It has a cost of somewhere around kind of £10,000. And we had this negotiation of, well, we'll put it in when somebody is employed. But the reality is nobody will be employed. Because when that person meets whatever criteria it is in order to be good enough for that role, they then require a £10,000 investment to go to the bathroom. So again, it's about how do you create the conditions now? And it's that notion of sometimes when you build it, they might come. But if you don't build it, they'll never come.
Sinead, thanks a million for coming in to us.
Thank you.
Sinead Burke, CEO, founder of Tilting the Lens. Back in a moment.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.